Welcome back to Schnepps Connects. Today, we're joined by Paul S. Ryan, who is the executive director of the New York City Campaign Finance Board. Paul is a nationally recognized expert in campaign finance and democratic participation and brings decades of experience in advancing transparency and accountability in elections. Before stepping into his role at the CFB in February 2024, he served as deputy executive director of the Funders Committee for Civic Participation and held senior leadership roles at Common Cause and the Campaign Legal Center. Under his leadership, the New York City Campaign Finance Board continues its mission to make democracy work better for all New Yorkers. The board administers one of the most effective public matching funds programs in the country, helping to amplify everyday voices and reduce the influence of big money in local politics. From enforcing campaign finance laws to engaging voters through initiatives like NYC Votes, the Campaign Finance Board plays a critical role in strengthening civic participation and ensuring transparency in city elections. So, Paul, thanks so much for joining. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, would love to just maybe start off by saying, how'd you get into this? Campaign finance, what was your trajectory and what was your passion that led you to the role you're currently in?
Well, I'm going to date myself here. In my late teens and early 20s, this is back in the 1990s, I got involved in electoral politics by volunteering on ballot measure campaigns and candidate campaigns. I was doing this in a few different places around the United States at the time. And through those experiences as a campaign volunteer, I came to believe that there's just a lot of room for improvement in how we do elections here in the United States to make elections and government itself more inclusive, to make office holders who are holding public office at every level of government more reflective of the communities that they serve. So I decided to go to law school and become an election lawyer with a goal of doing nonpartisan election reform work in the nonprofit sector. When I was looking at law schools back in the 1990s, there was one legal textbook on the topic of election law in print, and its author was on the faculty at UCLA Law School, a guy named Dan Lowenstein. I figured that if I could, I should study under the professor who literally wrote the book on the subject. So I applied to UCLA. I was fortunate enough to be admitted to UCLA Law School, and that's where I began building my career in this space. One of the cool programs that UCLA had at the time, and I presume they still have, they called it an externship program. It enabled me to come here to New York City and work full-time for 7 months at the Brennan Center for Justice and get academic credit. So I did that during law school, went back to LA, finished my law school and started working right away at a nonpartisan nonprofit in Los Angeles called the Center for Governmental Studies. And as coincidence would have it, one of my first projects out of law school was researching and writing and publishing a report analyzing New York City's public campaign financing program. And so I published findings and recommendations for how the program could be strengthened. Some of those were turned into law here in New York City, taken up by the City Council, a Charter Revision Commission later for some of those reforms. They were some of my first sort of policy wins in the political world. And I've been a super fan of New York City's Campaign Finance Board and the programs it's administered ever since. But after a few years at this place in LA at the Center for Governmental Studies, I moved to DC, Washington, DC, for a job at a nonprofit there that was then very new, a place called the Campaign Legal Center. I spent 12 years there litigating campaign finance and other election law issues, usually defending them from constitutional challenge, and also writing laws for cities and states and federal legislation, so legislation for folks all over the country. After 12 years there, 2016, fast forwarding, I had an opportunity to move to the National Office of Common Cause. I served as Common Cause's vice president for policy and litigation for about 5.5 years or so. And then I spent a few years in philanthropy doing democracy movement philanthropy work at the employer you mentioned in your intro, Funders Committee for Civic Participation. And then late in 2023, my dream job opened up. I applied for the role of executive director at the New York City Campaign Finance Board. I was offered the job at the end of 2023, and I started this role in February of last year. So I've been on the job a little over a year, about 15 months. And, you know, I mentioned a few minutes ago, I wrote that a report on this city's programs more than 20 years ago. It's kind of career coming full circle landed a stream job. So I couldn't be happier to be in this role. It's really been an honor to serve in this capacity, serve the people of New York City for the past year and a few months.
So talk about, since your role started, some of the changes that you've implemented, or maybe anything that you wrote in that report all those years ago that still rings true today.
Well, two things I'll mention from that report so many years ago. For the first almost 15 plus, between 15 and 20 years of this program's existence, the contribution limits that were enacted as part of this program, much, much lower than state law limits, they only applied to candidates who opted into the public financing program. One of the recommendations I made was that those contribution limits be applied to all candidates running for city office here in New York City, whether or not you opt into the public financing program. That was one of the reforms that the city council actually enacted a couple years after I published that report. And then the other issue that I addressed in that report was disclosure for independent spending. And independent expenditures, they've only become a bigger deal in the intervening 20 years or so. But back in the early 2000s, when I was researching that report, New York City had no disclosure requirements for spending by outside groups. These are groups that are not run by the candidates, but that support candidates expressly or explicitly. They used to not have any disclosure requirements. City law was changed, hopefully, I'd like to think, at least influenced by or inspired by my recommendation in my report, to require some disclosure by these groups. So at a minimum, voters know who's spending money to try to influence their votes. Those are two of the policy recommendations that became law. And the independent expenditure thing is a big issue, even in this year's election, that continues to be a big issue.
You know, I'd love to hear from you what you're seeing in terms of voter trends, turnout, and things of that nature, because, you know, I always feel that it's critical to inform people and let them know of their options, where they can go to vote, how to register. Yet, it's very difficult to get people out to vote. As important as these elections are, local, you know, even regional, national, it's really difficult to get people out. So I'd love to hear any trends that you see or that you have access to, or, you know, giving people greater access or opportunities to kind of really just strengthen that civic engagement.
It's a really important topic. I share your interest in and concern about voter engagement. The New York City Campaign Finance Board, it really has two big programs. I've talked a little bit about one already, the public financing program, and maybe we'll get a little bit more into that in a few minutes, administering that public financing campaign finance program. The other big pillar of work here at the Campaign Finance Board is voter engagement and voter education. We do that work through our NYC Votes programming. And, you know, so your listeners hopefully have seen NYC Votes messaging on subways and bus shelters and murals. We're all over the city. We do some radio advertising, all of which is aimed towards getting more people out to vote on election day. It's all done from a nonpartisan perspective. You asked about trends and data. We keep tabs on all of these voting trends and data, and we release an annual voter analysis report after every election year. We just published our voter analysis report for the 2024 elections a couple weeks ago.
Okay.
The city charter requires us to do this analysis and publish these reports. So some of the top line takeaways, I'll give you a few.
Yeah, I'd love to hear it.
So New York City has a voting population, these are citizens of voting age, of about 5.5 million people.
Wow.
We've got about 4.7 million of these folks who are actually registered. That's more than 85%.
And so
New York City does not have a voter registration problem. We have really good voter registration rates among those who are eligible. We do, however, have a voter turnout problem. We have a voter participation problem. 2024 general election, and it was a presidential election, as you and your listeners
know. Which is typically, I would assume, one of the larger turnouts.
Exactly. It is the largest turnout of any election in any like four-year cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And so for last fall's November general election, we had about 2.8 million voters turn out. That's just over 60%, which is pretty good. You know, not awesome, doesn't blow you away. But if I were to tell you about the numbers for voter participation in city races, which are held in an odd number of years, we have them coming up next month, the June primary, the turnout for city elections ranges anywhere from, you know, under 10% if there's no mayoral candidates on the ballot in the non-citywide races too, you know, sometimes getting up to 12, 13%. It's not just
low.
It's really low. We've got a very small segment of the population that's actually deciding who's running this city, and City Hall and the other citywide offices and the borough president's offices, City Council. So we got to do better. NYC.
Oh, question for you, and I don't know if you have the answer, but how does that trend nationally? Do you know?
Well, one of the things that we know to be true based on data analysis is that when elections are held has a big impact on who shows up.
Sure.
And similarly, how often you're asking is related. How often you're asking people to show up at the polls influences how many people show up. The more often you expect people to take time off from work, maybe unpaid time from work, the lower the voter participation. So having New York City's elections in odd numbered years is a problem. One of the recommendations we've made both in this voter analysis report and several years running is that city elections need to be aligned with federal and state elections. We need to move them to even years. That will automatically take us from 8, 9, 10, 12% voter participation up to 60 plus percent just with that policy move. It's going to require a state constitutional amendment achieve. So it's kind of a heavy lift in the world of like policy making. How do we get this done? But it's doable, and we are recommending it and working on it.
What would be a reason not to? What would be the opposing view? Is there one, you think, or just a matter of doing it?
I don't want to speak for the opponents, but I will say, and this is kind of taken off my campaign finance board hat because we haven't actually published statements along these lines, but driving my entire career for 25 plus years is, you know, not everybody, including some of the major players in politics, they don't necessarily want everyone to show up and vote.
Sure. Yeah.
Lower voter turnout is easier to predict and easier to control.
Listen, I remember there were years where, you know, the Lower East Side wasn't developed, supposedly because they didn't want a population change, right? The elected officials there. So you never, people don't want shifts in their voting habits or in their electorate.
Yeah, but the thing that we're focused on at the Campaign Finance Board, we're taking a positive message, we're trying to figure out what the solutions are and not so much worried about the motivations of people who might oppose us. Tell you, in addition to this alignment of elections and really centering voters in the scheduling of elections, you know, the highest criteria for when we're figuring out how to arrange the election calendar, when we hold elections, how often we hold elections, it should be the voters. It should be prioritizing making it as easy as possible for eligible voters to get to the polls.
Sure.
So one way of doing that is aligning city elections with federal and state elections. Another is reducing the number of times we're asking voters to show up for special elections. Because we do that a lot here in New York City.
Yeah.
We could make some minor policy changes that would have special elections fall on the same days as other elections, whenever possible. That should be a priority. And right now, it just isn't part of the
Listen, it would probably save the city a lot of money, too.
It would save.
It takes a lot to staff these elections.
Yeah, these elections cost millions of dollars to hold. The other big thing we saw in the voter analysis report when we were crunching numbers from 2024 has to do with unaffiliated voters. Our biggest takeaway probably from our analysis of data from last year's elections is that one in five New Yorkers are unaffiliated, meaning they're not registered with a political party. And because our system is a closed primary system, that means only Democrats, registered Democrats can vote in the Democratic primary, only registered Republicans can vote in the Republican primary. That means one in five New Yorkers are locked out of participating in the upcoming June primary elections for city office. And that's, you know, where most of the action is in New York City, given the party registration numbers in the city.
Yeah.
Most of the action is in the primary election. So unaffiliated voters, they are disproportionately younger. More than a quarter are under 30, and nearly half of unaffiliated voters are under 40 years old. You know, when you crunch the numbers, unaffiliated voters, they're the second largest voting bloc in the city after Democrats. Registered Dems make up about two-thirds of the electorate. Unaffiliated voters make up 21%. Way more, almost double Republicans. Registered Republicans make up 11%. So, you know, we're leaving a huge segment of our population out of the game, out of the process altogether through the way we're choosing to run our election. So, you know, we need to come up with some public policy solutions. And a few more things from this voter analysis report that we have published. Research on young voters, including the barriers that they face in voter education and outreach and participation, already touched on this, which is really taking a voter-centric approach to scheduling elections, but also every other aspect of how we're designing and implementing elections. The rules need to make it easy for qualified electors to vote. And we can do that without increasing risk of fraud. You know, we have almost non-existent voter fraud or election fraud in this country, despite what some people say. And it's really easy to make elections more accessible without adding any risk of fraud. The one last thing we recommend in this voter analysis report that relates to some of this is that the state of New York join what is called the Electronic Registration Information System. It's usually known as ERIC for short.
Okay.
This is a sort of a coalition across states for data sharing so that when people move, my wife and I, my family moved here to New York City from DC for this job, there is very little information sharing between states for voter registration rolls. So people get kicked off voter rolls. It's hard to re-register to vote when you move to places. Sometimes you miss the deadlines to do so before you even realize the deadline has passed. So if the state of New York were to join ERIC, this electronic registration information system, it would make the voting rolls more accurate through the entire state of New York by sharing data across jurisdictions.
Let's talk a little bit about the matching funds program, because for those who don't know it, it's really a critical part of leveling the playing field for candidates. Could you share a little bit about that program?
Yeah, I think it's the best program in the country. I say this after spending more than 20 years studying and working on every cities and states all around the country, including those that have these sorts of public financing programs. New York City's is one of the oldest, and it is definitely one of the most effective. So what our program does, this matching funds program, it really amplifies the power of average New Yorkers in city elections by matching small contributions with public funds. Our program matches eligible small contributions from New Yorkers, from New York City residents, 8-1, allowing candidates to spend more time connecting with constituents and hearing what matters to them, and less time chasing down big checks, chasing down wealthy donors and special interests. So I mentioned we only match small contributions. That means contributions up to $250 for citywide office, mayor, comptroller, public advocate, and contributions up to $175 for borough president and council races. And what we find is that when campaigns are powered by these contributions from regular people, it means elected officials, they're accountable to all New Yorkers, all the people they serve, and not just the people that can write big checks. So we have a bunch of different dates where our board meets. We have a 5-member nonpartisan board, meets a bunch of times to consider applications for public funds by candidates, and then we cut the checks right after those meetings for those candidates who are deemed eligible. The next board meeting, where the board will make public funds determinations, eligibility decisions, is coming up on May 30th. There's another one on June 20th. And then there's 5 between the primary and the general elections, one on July 15th, and then 4 more between July 15th and November election. So we got a lot of rules. It's not easy to qualify from the candidate's perspective. Candidates need to agree to a spending limit. They need to agree to be rigorously audited by the Campaign Finance Board, because our job as an agency is to make sure these tax dollars are being spent properly.
Sure, it's a lot of money.
That are getting them are abiding by the rules. You know, so we spend a lot of time and effort and impose a lot of requirements and rules on candidates. Mm-hmm. But it's a really good bargain for the candidate.
So if a candidate gets, let's just give an example, just to make sure I'm following you correctly, make sure the listeners understand. So if someone's running for citywide office and they get small donations from someone that lives, they have to have an address living in New York City to be eligible, and that person can give a maximum donation for matching purposes of $250. And if that qualifies, the city of New York would add $2,000, 8-1. Is that, am I getting that right?
Yes.
Okay.
I think that math is right. I usually, when I'm talking about this,
yeah, I'm putting you on the stage.
Yeah, I mean, I pick easy numbers, and the easiest way we explain this to folks is that if you make a $10 contribution to a candidate for mayor, we're going to kick in $80. So the candidate gets $90. Your $10 plus the $80 that the city.
So that's a big deal. I mean, for every dollar someone in New York City gives me, the city will match it with $8.
Yeah, it's a really big deal. And the candidates can be raising bigger checks. If you opt into our program, if you're running for mayor, you can take a contribution up to $2,100, but we're only going to match the first $250.
Got it. That makes
sense.
And
the reason is because we want to incentivize candidates to spend more time with regular New Yorkers. And
is there a maximum amount of those small donations that the city matches?
Yes. So
it's like a cap, I assume?
It ends up being We have the spending limit itself. I'll give you some numbers here.
Because I assume that the use of online donations probably has helped that, especially for campaigns that are sophisticated, and most of the citywide ones I'm sure are, versus some of the smaller campaigns. But I have to imagine that, you know, people can accumulate a lot of them.
Yeah, we have really high participation. The starting point, I think, for understanding how much money we're talking is the spending limit. So running for city council in the June primary, a city council candidate, their spending is capped at $228,000 for the primary election. They can receive up to about 89% of that money in public funds. So the max amount of public funds for a council candidate is going to be in the primary $202,000. But almost all of them, subject to that spending limit, they can
get. So there's millions of dollars that the city is contributing to make sure that candidates, no matter their background, have a fair shot at working to market their campaign. I mean, more or less. Is that right? So yeah, if someone doesn't come in and say, listen, I have money and I'm just going to spend it, or I get a couple of checks and I can outspend everybody because people wouldn't have that ability to raise money from the city.
Yeah,
so well, the city's more or less giving everybody a shot.
Yeah, candidates can self-fund. They can choose to do that and stay out of our program. But this program, it gives regular New Yorkers, it makes it easier for regular New Yorkers. I'm talking about teachers and small business owners, community leaders, people who should be in City Hall, people who should be in the City Council. This program gives them a shot to run competitive campaigns for office and win, a better shot than they have anywhere else in the United States. It's because of this program. And I'm really proud of the program. And it's just such an honor to be part of the
team. It must be a big responsibility, though, and a lot of work.
Ton of work
to, you know, implement this and, you know, safeguard it.
Yeah, it's a ton of work. We've taken some criticism for how rigorous our audits are and what we require candidates and campaigns to go through. But, you know, our clients are the taxpayers of the city of New York, the people of the city of New York. We are giving out significant amounts of money. So far in this election cycle, for the primaries coming up, we've given out about $42 million to more than 90 candidates.
Wow.
Participating in our program.
Yeah, it's a lot of candidates.
Yeah, so it's big money, and we do have a big team of auditors, and we are going to ask candidates for a lot of documentation. And it's two sides of the same coin. We've got this great program that makes it possible for anyone who puts in some serious effort, has some base of public support, makes it possible for any of them to run a competitive campaign for office. We're going to give them public funds to do it, and they need to do their part of the deal.
How do you go back and look at it to make sure it's working the way you want to? Not in terms of people qualifying or, you know, going around the system, whatever that might be. But I'm really talking about making sure it's serving the opportunity for people from every community to be able to run for office. How do you go about looking at that?
So one of the things I noticed in the, you know, more than 20 years ago when I was researching and writing that report I mentioned earlier in our conversation is that there's a provision in the New York City Charter, and it's like the Constitution for the City of New York, that requires this agency to study and publish reports and hold hearings to analyze how the program is working. So one of the defining characteristics of New York City's program, and I'll compare it to the federal program for presidential elections, which these days most people younger than me don't even know there's a public financing program at the federal level, because the last time the major candidates used it was 2008. I'll compare the two. So in New York City, after every election, the campaign finance board staff, they hold public hearings and they crunch the numbers. And what they've learned over time, when this program was created back in the late 80s, the matching funds rate was $1 in public funds to $1 in private contributions up to a cap. And we've learned that it wasn't effectively incentivizing candidates to really focus their fundraising efforts and their campaign with people, regular New Yorkers, people of modest means. So the matching funds rate went up to 2-1 and then 4-1.
Wow.
And we kept studying and kept studying, saying, what tweaks can we make to this program? I'm saying we, but I wasn't here at the time, but my predecessors, what adjustments can be made to this program to better accomplish the aims of giving everyday New Yorkers power as contributors, because candidates are going to focus on them and engage with them? And what tweaks can we make that will make it possible for everyday New Yorkers, give them power as candidates? And this gradual increase over the decades of the matching funds rate from 1-1, now up to 8-1. That was done intentionally, and it was based on data analysis. By comparison, the federal program, public financing program for the presidential elections, was created in the early 70s. with no requirement for ongoing study. The public funding amounts didn't increase over time. It was equivalent of a car that was built in the early 70s and never taken into the shop for maintenance. And by 20 years ago, it was already on life support, and it's now completely useless as a program. No major candidates use it. So the requirement in the law that this agency constantly revisit and analyze the effectiveness of the program has been a key to its success. And the agency's skill at doing that, equally important. And it doesn't happen everywhere. We shouldn't be taken for granted, but it's a really cool aspect of this city's program.
Yeah, no, that's good to hear. But talk about some of the innovative approaches that you're looking at in terms of outreach, because we talked a lot about education and mobilizing more New Yorkers, particularly in those non-presidential election cycles. What can you talk about in terms of ways in which you're thinking about or implementing to be able to get more people participating in elections?
Within our NYC Votes program, we take a couple of different approaches. One thing is mail-in materials, informational materials directly to registered voters. So most of your listeners will be familiar with the voter guide that will be showing up in the next couple of weeks. And that profiles every candidate, gives voters helpful information to make up their minds on who they want to vote for. We are also now investing a lot of resources in educating voters about a new aspect of New York City elections that's been in effect since 2021, which is ranked choice voting. I love it. I think it's the best way to run elections and cast ballots. It only exists in a handful of places in the United States. Some voters aren't that familiar with it. So we just sent a mail piece. Mine hit my mailbox, I think on Monday of this week or maybe Friday, instructions on how to cast a ranked choice ballot, and then a QR code that you can scan on the mail piece that whenever should be showing up in everyone's mailboxes. So you can go onto our website and actually use an interactive ballot. That's fun. We kind of gamify.
I want to make sure we do a story and share a link to that. That's important.
Yeah. And another exciting thing that's brand new, first time this election cycle that hit mailboxes of all New York City voters a couple of weeks ago, is an explainer on this public financing program, explaining to voters all over the city that if they can and if they do make a small contribution, a $10, $20, $100 contribution to a participating candidate, it gets matched and it builds their power and their voice in New York City politics. So direct mail, one aspect of our work. Another aspect of our work I mentioned earlier in our conversation was public advertising, information on subway cars, information at bus shelters, murals, radio ads. We partner with sports teams. We do promotional events, all trying to drive people to the NYC Votes website. We present as much information as we can on the face of the ad itself, whatever it is. But then we're also trying to drive people who want, we think about it, we talk about it as the bite, snack, meal approach to education and advertising. And most of these ads, they're the bite. And if we can hook you with it, get you to scan the QR code, we're going to get you to the snack or the meal on our website, more information, as much as you want to learn about these programs. And then the last thing I'll mention is that we've got a whole team, our partnerships and outreach team, that partner with hundreds of community-based organizations around New York City, every borough, where we are doing educational events in community. We do educational events in language. We have American Sign Language. We create our materials in 13 languages plus English to make all of this stuff available and accessible to all the New Yorkers. That's our job, to educate all New Yorkers in their communities, in the languages that they speak. And I'm proud of the work that our team is doing on that.
Well, listen, and you're here on this podcast in a busy time. So I'm really appreciative of your time and, you know, the work that you do. I know you must be busy leading up to the primary. This one is definitely unique in a lot of different ways, but I think it's really important that people just get out there and vote. A lot of people like to complain, but I always say you're not entitled to complain if you don't vote.
If you vote,
then you're allowed to complain. Thank you for all your work and for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Remember to subscribe to Schneps Connects wherever you can. You can listen to us at podcast.schnepsmedia.com or stream us on any podcast platform.